Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Mike Herhold, president of the First Friday Club of Greater Akron. On behalf of myself and the First Friday Club board, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for coming to our May 2024 program. Our very special presenter for today is Dr. Mike Pressimon. His topic will be Teaching the Faith in a Faithless World, the Importance of Catholic Intellectual Tradition. Please silence your cell phones so that all can enjoy today's program. And after the presentation, you'll have the opportunity to present questions for our speaker. After the talk, we'll have a short announcement break to collect the question cards and then have a question-answer session. The cards are on the table, so if any time during the talk you think of a question, please write it down. It's now my pleasure to introduce Walsh Jesuit High School student Nathan Klug, who will offer our opening prayer.
In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. God, thank you for bringing us together today. We give you thanks for this gift that we are invited to engage in hope, joy, and love as your followers. Open our hearts and our eyes to see our community as you would have seen them. Help us to find courage to sit and hear others when so often we want to be heard first. You are good and you are gracious, O God. Amen.
Thank you, Nathan. It's now my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Mike Pressimon, currently Vice President for Advancement at St. Bonaventure University. He's a native of Baltimore, Maryland, and is a first-generation college student. He holds an Associate of Arts degree from Cantonsville Community College, a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the Catholic University of America, a Master in Leadership in Higher Education from Regis University, and a Doctorate in Higher Education and Organizational Change from Benedictine University. His higher education career spans more than three decades. He served as Vice President of Advancement at Alvernia University, Belmont Abbey College, and Elizabethtown College. He served as President of Font Vaughn University and Notre Dame of Ohio. His background and experience in advancement and fundraising led to some of the largest campaigns. In Alvernia, he surpassed a fundraising goal of $31 million and another campaign at Elizabethtown that raised $26 million. But aside from being a moneymaker, he's a strong relationship builder with a reputation for teamwork, collaboration, and an ability and passion for bringing together students, faculty, and staff to achieve mutually beneficial goals. He's also been an active voice on the issues of diversity and racial justice. He's written in support of greater diversity and inclusion in both the news media and for his campus constituency. He and his wife, Kathy, who is here with him today, have 12 children, and I hope my figure is right for 11 grandchildren, but it might be more. Again, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Mike.
I'm going to elaborate a little bit more on some of that stuff as we go through this program. So great to be with you on this beautiful day, and it's also great to have our young students from Walsh and Hoban and Our Lady of the Elms as well. Some of this, I'm going to talk about Catholic education. It's great that you're here because you're kind of a testament to kind of what we're still striving for. But today, I want to talk to you about the Hebrew Academy of Cleveland. We live next to the Hebrew Academy of Cleveland in Cleveland Heights. We're in transition right now. I left Notre Dame back in the fall, secured a new position at St. Bonaventure earlier this spring, and so I'm living in New York, and Kathy's still living in Cleveland Heights. We're getting ready to sell a house, and you're doing all those things that you know, you guys don't have to worry about it yet. Maybe you've experienced with your moms and dads, but those of you who've moved a bit, you know what it's like to try to sell a house, you know. So I come home on the weekends, and that's a honeydew list is not really accurate. It's like a honeydew almanac is kind of what it feels like. But anyway, so we live in a neighborhood of Cleveland Heights, and if you know that area, we are actually in a very heavily Orthodox Jewish community. And so we're on kind of a little private street adjacent to what was the old Oakwood Country Club. And back in the day, you know, a lot of our communities, there was the Jewish Country Club, and there was the Protestant Country Club, and there was the Catholic Country Club. And some of that has gone away today, but that country club closed. And the Hebrew Academy of Cleveland bought that property. They built a beautiful school there. They now have, between the boys' campus and the girls' campus, like 1,450 students, and they're growing. And one of our neighbors invited us to a celebration of the bar mitzvah of one of their sons. And so we went to the academy for this huge party. And the two rabbis that run the academy are brothers. And it was their father that started the academy many years ago. And Rabbi Dessler is his name, Simcha Dessler. He said, "Let me show you around," because they had built this beautiful new space. So we walked all around the school, and it was terrific. And they, of course, a lot of their Judaism is very present in the symbols that we see in the school. And I said, "Well, this is really terrific." He says, "You know," he said, "we just really felt that if we wanted to preserve our faith, we needed to teach our children." And I said, "And please don't take offense at this, especially those of you who are here representing Catholic schools." I said, "There was a time when we as Catholics used to feel more strongly about that. There was a time. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. My wife was born in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, but grew up outside of Baltimore, Maryland. Fortunately, I was asked whether I wanted technology or a screen, because I would start showing embarrassing pictures of my wife and I when we were younger. So that's why I said, no technology, it's fine. I was my wife's senior prom date in high school. So whoever you take to prom this year, anybody, if you're a senior, you may wind up with them for the rest of your life, just so you know. And it was the happiest thing that ever happened to me, just so you know. But let me tell you about my growing up as a Catholic kid in Baltimore. Went to St. Benedict's Elementary School, closed. I went to Cardinal Gibbons High School, closed. My wife went to the neighboring Archbishop Keough High School, which was the girls' school, closed. Unfortunately, you know, I heard I was former president of Notre Dame College, closing the semester. I was president of Fontbonne University in St. Louis, closing next year. Two of my daughters went to Cabrini University in Philadelphia, closed. Last year alone, 15 Catholic colleges in the country closed.
Wow.
Okay. So when we talk about Catholic education and what we're seeing happening in Catholic higher education, some of it goes back to the commitment that we make to education pre-K through 12, because that market is dwindling for us. The Hebrew Academy seems to get it. There are people, and again, it's like, from what the rabbi tells me, it's the largest Hebrew Academy of its kind east of the Mississippi. And there are people that will move from other parts of the country in order to be near the academy to send their kids there. And I wonder what it's going to take for us to kind of get back to that. But let me give you a little bit more statistics about what's going on. For those of us who are of a certain age, we'll remember these things, right? And these are quotes. These are the National Catholic Education Association statistics as reported in Private School Review. U.S. Catholic school enrollment reached its peak during the early 60s when more than 5.2 million students in almost 13,000 schools across the nation. That's when we started school. Once we left, it just went downhill from there. The 1970s and 80s saw a steep decline in both the number of schools and students, and by 1990, there were approximately 2.5 million students in 8,719. So that's a little bit more than a 50% drop in Catholic school enrollment in about three decades. From the mid-90s to 2000, there was a little steady enrollment increase, about 1.3%, but there were still closings of schools. As we saw, I know, in the Diocese of Cleveland, there were school closings, and it's been all over the place. Between the 2000 and 2011 school years, an additional 1,755 schools were reported closed or consolidated, or 25% of the total number at that time. The number of students during that period declined by more than 500,000. That's the backdrop against which we talk about Catholic higher education and what we're trying to do. The decline affects our church and our colleges and universities. Many parents, not yours obviously, no longer see the value of investing in Catholic school education. And that decline has had a definite impact on Catholic college and university enrollment and has changed the marketing we do as institutions to attract students. And it's interesting, I'm going to talk about what we call the Catholic intellectual tradition. You know, Catholic education was not new, right? It was kind of new in America, you know, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But the Catholic intellectual tradition goes back a long time. It's an ancient tradition. I look at it this way. As humans, we are inquisitive people. From the time we could speak, we started asking questions. We see that biblically as well. Adam saying, "Why can't I eat that apple?" Later we hear Abraham asking his famous series of questions, "What if 50? 5 less than 50, 40, 30, 10, will you spare the city of Sodom?" Later still we hear the question, "Surely it's not I, Lord." We are inquisitive. This innate spirit of inquisitiveness created the framework for a great history in education and the life of the mind, which we refer to as the Catholic intellectual tradition, much of which was promulgated, founded at the University of Paris. That's where we saw Saints Ignatius, Bonaventure, Thomas Aquinas, among notable faculty and alumni of that institution. Others include great Franciscan philosophers John Duns Scotus and William of Ockham at Oxford, and Augustinian Gregor Mendel at the forefront of modern genetics. Well, now that I'm working at a Franciscan institution, St. Bonaventure is a Franciscan institution, and the aforementioned Alvernia, where I worked in Pennsylvania, is also a Franciscan institution. I feel at home in that Franciscan tradition. And some of it gets back to some of these stories. You know, Francis, you know, when you think of St. Francis, you know, I always said, people get St. Francis, right? He's kind of an easier to understand, although he's much more complex than people give him credit for. I said, the great thing about Francis is he's the only saint you can buy in the Home Depot. you can always get a garden statue of St. Francis, and there's usually a bird on the shoulder. You know, he's the animal guy. And, you know, at parishes and colleges and universities, when you have Franciscan feast days, we would have blessings of the animals. And we talk about, make me a channel of your peace. Francis was that guy, right? Francis, the guy, he lived in service to Christ. You know, that's what he did. But one of the early Franciscans was St. Anthony of Padua, okay? And one day, he goes to Francis and he says, he had actually been a Dominican before he joined Francis. He said, I think we need to teach the friars. And Francis was known to be not pro-education. He was pro-service. He was like, let's serve the poor. But he went, okay, Anthony, if you think we need to teach the friars, let's teach the friars. And so that's how the friars began a journey of education, and those people like John Duns Scotus became famous Franciscan scholars. Also interesting, there are a couple of different schools of thought within our kind of our Catholic life of the mind, right? There's Bonaventure, and there's Thomas Aquinas. And this story, it's kind of a tale. It's maybe apocryphal in many ways. You know, maybe one of those things that's more lore than it is real. But there's this story that at one point, Thomas Aquinas was on a horse over here, and St. Bonaventure was on a horse over here, and they're headed to the University of Paris to promulgate their theological philosophies. And Aquinas got there first. So we became a Thomistic church, not a Bonaventurian church. And what's the difference between being Thomistic and Bonaventurian? And I'll simplify this. I'm not a theologian. I'm a college administrator. But I've read a lot. Thomas saw it as there is sin, and we need to seek redemption through the love of God. Bonaventure said, there's love, and it's out of God's love that we exist. If you were giving me a choice, I would choose Bonaventure's approach, because I believe that God is love. Now, I don't think Thomas didn't say God's not love. He just first said there's sin, and we need God's love. Okay, so there's a difference there. So I feel really comfortable within that kind of Bonaventurian worldview. So that goes on, of course, for hundreds of years, University of Paris and Oxford. It's also interesting, of course, that these institutions, like University of Paris, was recognized by the king and by the pope. So they were kind of in this unique model that we see sometimes today, where we have this kind of support of the church and the state. In the U.S., we don't see that so much. But for instance, in Canada, I have some Catholic college president friends in Canada. They work for the government, but they're at Catholic institutions, so they have more of a symbiotic relationship, and other parts of the world are like that too. In the United States, of course, you know, we are a young country compared to Europe, right? We're a country of immigrants. So as people started coming to the United States, or to America, which eventually became the United States, many of them came seeking religious freedom. You know, you've all read about that in school, right? That's what you learned. And so you had groups of Protestants who had been persecuted that came over, and Congregationalists and Puritans, and they came over as communities, and they planted. They planted things. They planted communities. They planted churches. They planted hospitals. They planted schools. They planted colleges and universities. The first of those that got planted in the country was Harvard. Okay? Most people don't realize that Harvard was founded as a religious institution. Most of the Ivy League colleges in the country were founded by religious organizations. The only kind of remnants that exist today in most of those places is that they still maintain schools of divinity. But those schools of divinity are not congregationally oriented. So the Congregationalists established Harvard in 1636. Catholics were a little later coming to the United States. So it was really in the mid to late 1700s to the 1800s where we started seeing a great immigration from Europe to the United States, to America, with Catholics. And they followed a very similar pattern. So people came seeking opportunities to work, freedom from oppression, things like that. And the church kind of followed them through religious orders of women and men who came over to serve those communities. Similarly, they did what their Protestant friends did. They came in and they established churches, they established schools, they established hospitals, and they established colleges. The first Catholic institution founded in the country was Georgetown, which was founded in 1789. Despite entering the higher education game relatively late, Catholics went on to sponsor and establish, and I quote, the largest array of colleges and universities in the country. So the legacy of that was that, you know, once the Catholics came, well, they came big time. Right? And you think about it in terms of healthcare as well. So many wonderful healthcare systems in the country. You know, you think about how this occurred. You know, immigrants from Europe arrived in the East and slowly began a westward migration along with the rest of the country. And along the way, they established these churches and then dioceses and all of the other things I've talked about. And I've had the great pleasure to work for many congregations of women and men, and they really never cease to amaze me. Similarly, the Sisters of Notre Dame here in Cleveland, the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet in St. Louis, you know, think about this, especially you young people, think about this. First of all, there's no planes, okay, so no one hopped on a plane. I'm just going to say, so let's take this table of, I'm going to leave the guys out over here at Walsh, okay? So you group of young women, six of you, oh, you're not a student, are you?
No.
Well, they had to send someone as a chaperone, I guess. Literally, six of you, fully habited, okay, were said, we're going to send you to St. Louis from France, okay? You're going to walk to the nearest coastline. You're going to book passage on a ship that is not the Queen Mary. It's not Royal Dutch Caribbean Cruises, okay? It's a wooden boat, and you're going to get passage, so you're not even going to be first-class passengers. You're going to sail weeks and weeks and weeks across the ocean in really bad weather. You're never going to be in touch with your family and friends in France ever again. And you're going to arrive in New Orleans, Louisiana. Then you're going to get on another boat, and you're going to go up the Mississippi River to a French community in the lower part of St. Louis. And you're going to get off that boat, and you're going to say, well, I guess we need to live somewhere, and you're going to find someone to help you build a place where you can live. And then you're going to build a school. And then you're going to build a hospital. And you're going to do all of that without any of the conveniences that we have today. And without any money. Because they did not send a MasterCard with you. Okay? So you're going to have to also go around and you're going to have to raise the money. You're going to ask people for donations. Think about how extraordinarily brave those women had to be in order to do that, right? And we don't hear much about it, but I guarantee you that there were some women and men who did that journey that never made it, that died on board, or maybe the ship sank, or whatever it may be. But that story happened over and over and over and over. Think about, I don't know all of my Jesuit lore, Father, but I know similarly there were a group of Jesuits that left like Georgetown and went west. It was kind of like, see you guys, you know, good luck out there, you know, let us know. Send us a letter, I guess, at some point. But there was this passage. You know why they did it? Because they had faith. They believed that they were carrying out the work of God in doing this. So it's really extraordinary. And I just admire the women and men who did this. And today, those of us who work in Catholic education, we're in a different way, but similarly, we're carrying on that same mission. A little bit more in terms of the technical side of this. You know, most Catholic colleges and universities in the country are not what we call canonically erected. They're founded by these religious orders of women and men, but they're not, you know, they don't have the same kind of relationship to the church. Nor do they have ecclesiastical faculties. The exceptions are the few diocesan colleges that we have in the country, as well as the Catholic University of America, where I did my undergraduate degree, which is the primary canonically erected Catholic university in America. It is essentially under the direct control of the Vatican. And you go to the Board of Trustees meetings there, half of the board members are bishops of the United States. Half are lay people. But most of the colleges, so there's roughly 200 Catholic colleges and universities in the country. Most of them were founded by religious orders of women and men. They get their identity through what we call a sponsor. So we have the Jesuits at Walsh. Is Hoban sponsored by
Holy Cross?
Dominican. The Dominicans, the Holy Cross Fathers, the Jesuits are the sponsors of these institutions. Now, I mentioned earlier I went to Cardinal Gibbons High School, and I was educated by the Marianist brothers and fathers, but they were not a sponsored institution. It was a diocesan school staffed by the Marianists, so there can be different models. Sponsorship has kind of a unique meaning in Catholicism, right? Because there's a relationship that occurs within that sponsorship agreement. And you think about it, most of our institutions, most of the institutions in the country that were founded by these women and men, essentially were staffed largely by those women and men for many years of their existence. So it would not be unusual to go to a place like a Notre Dame in Cleveland and essentially in those early years have all of your instructors be sisters, or to have very few lay people on staff. Most of our schools would have been like that. That began to change in the United States in the 60s, you know, certainly post-Vatican II. You know, orders began to kind of say, is there other work that we should be doing? Are there other ways in which we can serve the church? Is it just education? Is it just healthcare? Are there other things to do? And we began to see kind of an opening, more of a laicization. And some of this can be proved out in statistics as well. So, for instance, Boston College, which was founded by the Jesuits, the percentage of Jesuits on the faculty decreased from 43% just after World War II to 21% in 1964-65. So even in those early years, we began to see a decline of the number of vowed religious that were actually occupying faculty positions on our Catholic colleges and campuses. You know, at first, the sponsor communities began to diminish as a percentage of the overall population of faculty and staff, but they maintained their presence in positions of leadership as presidents and in institutional governance. And in the mid-1960s and continuing through the post-Vatican II era, the number of men and women entering religious life sharply declined. And the men and women started leaving vowed religious life and living as lay men and women. And the presence of vowed religious men and women on college and university campuses they established also declined. Another issue plagued Catholic colleges and universities. There was the impression that they were not academically serious or rigorous. Some, like the University of Chicago president Robert Maynard Hutchins, who served from 1929 to 1951, he challenged the purpose of Catholic higher education, which he said, and I quote, was tainted by athleticism, collegiatism, vocationalism, and anti-intellectualism. Hutchins challenged Catholics to be true to their heritage and thereby demonstrate to the rest of the world that the intellectual tradition can again be made the heart of higher education, that intellectual tradition which was ancient and old and was really at the forefront of Catholic intellectual life. Up until the 1960s, Catholic colleges and universities had an internalist point of view which was seen as a weakness of the enterprise. There were significant voices who spoke out and called on Catholic colleges and universities to view their enterprise more objectively from an external point of view. Such voices included Catholic scholar John Tracy Ellis and University of Notre Dame President Theodore Ted Hesburgh, Holy Cross Father. And those who gathered with Hesburgh at the famous Land O'Lakes gathering in 1967. And the outcome of that gathering was the Land O'Lakes statement, the nature of a contemporary Catholic university. And the statement begins, and I quote, "The Catholic university today must be a university in the full modern sense of the word, with a strong commitment to and concern for academic excellence. Distinctively, then, the Catholic university must be an institution, a community of learners or a community of scholars in which Catholicism's perceptibly present and effectively operative." These two expressions really help kind of define what the Catholic college and university became in the post-1960s world. We had to be both academically rigorous, but also centered in our faith. And I think one of the things that we struggle with today is keeping that balance. Because, I'll go back to Maynard Hutchins' comments, you think about education today in general, we're focused on athleticism. You know, how much time do we spend today talking about, you know, I'm at a Division I basketball school now. We spend a lot of time talking about the NCAA and NIL and the amount of money that we're now pouring into college athletics. And those of us who are kind of liberal arts educated academic people are like, it doesn't quite feel right to us. You know, it's a little out of whack. Vocationalism. So I'm a liberal arts guy. Okay, I believe, and again, part of it, you know, Mike mentioned that I'm a first-gen college student. You know, neither my mom or dad graduated from high school. I'm still not exactly sure how I made it, except I have a really good partner over here, and she kind of prompted me to be better. But, you know, I was not necessarily the most obvious college-bound guy, because I was like, okay, I guess I should do college. I wasn't sure. But it wasn't necessarily the path that I was going to pursue. It was really, let's get a job, right? Because my parents were blue-collar people. You went out and you got a job. But there was something about, you know, the pursuit of college and the pursuit of knowledge that kind of kept prompting me. But what we see today now, of course, and again, I think about your parents out there, is how many of you are seniors? Anybody? Good, you have time to think about this then. You know, when you get ready to start thinking about college, right, there's going to be the voice in the back of your head, maybe it's your own voice, maybe it's mom and dad's voice saying, well, you go to college and you get a job, okay? I have nothing against you getting a job, right? But it's not just vocationalism. It's not just about getting a job. It's also about going back to those early years, it's developing your mind. It's engaging with big questions. It's about thinking about faith in the context of life. And that's where the liberal arts and humanities really come to play. So for me, when I eventually went off to, you know, we didn't even list all the places I attended because I dropped out of my first college, literally, and then went to a community college, and then went to Catholic U. And it was a Catholic U where I, you know, as a part of the core curriculum, I had to take philosophy and I had to take theology and I studied French. I was like, wow, you know, life is really interesting. And my undergraduate, I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in theater. I know, shocking, isn't it? You know, I have to say, though, my liberal arts education, my theater degree, has held up very well. And people would say to me, even back when I first became a vice president, they would say, well, you have a theater, because when I was a vice president, I only had a bachelor's degree at that time. They said, how'd you get to be a vice president? You have just a bachelor's degree. I said, well, today I'm acting like a vice president. And so it was the ability to communicate. It's the ability to think. It's the ability to reason. So when you do go to college, please don't go solely focused on what you're going to do for a living. Think about your life more holistically than that, because the reality is, statistics bear this out, that whatever you happen to major in, whatever job you think you're going to pursue, by the time you're 5 years out of college, it'll change completely. Or you might change completely. You might say, I really thought I wanted to be an accountant. Nothing against accountants. But, you know, I'd really rather write. You know, something like that. Don't deny those possibilities for you. I've digressed enough. The other thing we see, what's really plaguing us in higher education today, of course, we have this decline in Catholic education, but we also see a decline in our church. We're not seeing as many young people in our church. I'll go back to my story of the Hebrew Academy. If the life of faith is important to us, we need to be teaching more about our faith. Now, we, of course, those of us who are parents, who are the first teachers, right? We are. So it's imperative on us to be able to do that, to deliver that. But what was great for me growing up, because my path wasn't necessarily like that, I had a really supportive Catholic school community because my parents sent me to Catholic school that helped continue to develop that. I think the same was with Kathy, although she had a much stronger Catholic family than I did. When we look at statistics, and you like do things like market surveys on why are students coming to Catholic colleges and universities, you know, what are the things that you're looking at first? Price, location, program are always at the top of the list. Way down at the bottom of the list is the religious or faith identity of the institution. Okay? Now, those of us who work in Catholic higher education, we look at that, we say, well, there's a challenge there, because more and more of our students are coming from backgrounds where they have an uncomfortable relationship with church, they have no relationship with church, they are in a rebellious relationship with church. And so those of us who work in Catholic higher education say, okay, so what are we going to do to help these students develop a sense that life is more than just the work that they're pursuing or the sport that they're playing? So what we try to do in Catholic higher education, depending on where we are, is we say, okay, so that interest was down here, but over the course of 4 or 5 years, we want that interest to rise to the top so that you see your work as a part of the mission of the institution and you're informed by that. So one of the things, and again, I'm relatively new at St. Bonaventure, but I've known the institution for a long time. You know, we have a very well-known school of communications called the Giandoli School of Communications. It used to be media, mass marketing, and all the things, but now it's just communications. But they talk about the work of their students is that how they act in the media today should be informed by our Franciscan heritage as an institution so that we seek truth. Okay? And that's something that we see too little of today. We're not all that concerned with truth today. We're more concerned with opinion, right? So the seeking of truth and the sharing of truth is an important part of that philosophy. Well, is Catholic education only for the faithful? Sometimes those of us who are challenged, I could tell you at one of the challenges we had at Notre Dame, 85% of our students were not Catholic. So, but those of us who were there, we saw that work as a part of the evangelical role of the institution. Is that they may not have come in Catholic, and they may not leave Catholic, but they come in with no understanding, and they leave with some understanding of what that means. And a lot of the institutions in the country serve that purpose, especially more of your urban serving Catholic institutions. There are other schools that are well known, Franciscan University of Steubenville, even University of Notre Dame to a certain extent, Ave Maria in Florida, that, you know, are very doctrinally aligned, very much in relationship with kind of some current ways of thinking in the church. But they're only teaching those who are already evangelized. Okay? So those people that go there opt in because that's who I am and that's where I want to be. But it's like, how do we evangelize as a church? How do we as institutions fulfill the new evangelization? What's the role that we play in helping to say that this church has value? You know, in terms of the sponsorship relationship, there are three levels that Grant and Vandenberg describe in terms of what sponsorship looks like. You know, first there's what we call permission. The sponsor acknowledges that the paradigm has shifted in terms of what the new model of sponsorship is going to look like. And then there's preparation, which is the intentional formation of those who follow, people like me who are not members of a vowed religious community. And then there's praxis, the union of action and reflection. So as we go through this period where we used to have lots of nuns and priests and brothers running our institutions, which has now declined, you know, just the statistics I can tell you about my previous institution, the average age of a sister of Notre Dame was 78 years old, and 90% of them were over 70. Okay? And so their decision to withdraw sponsorship from Notre Dame College was really a reflection on kind of the aging of their community. And we're seeing that repeated over and over and over and over again in our country. Okay? Underpinning all of this is what Grant and Vandenberg referred to as a theology of sponsorship, which acknowledges each individual's call to holiness. All of us have that call to holiness. Through our baptism, we're called to ministry. And sponsorship calls us to serve in a way that is bound together by gospel spirituality, a deep sense of personal and mutual accountability, and commitment to the continuity of the ministry and to fidelity to the mission. That's the new paradigm. that's what we're trying to do as lay women and men who are working in these institutions, like the high schools that are in the room, the colleges and universities around the country. We're trying to make sure that we kind of embrace and magnify that mission. The danger there, of course, is that sometimes we hide behind mission versus faith. So I had a conversation with the, you know, within the Franciscan community, the head of the local community is called the guardian. That's what Francis called the head of the community. I was having a conversation with the guardian. Just so you know, I'm currently living in the friary. Okay, so I'm living religious life during the week and married life on the weekend. And it might be a model for the church. I don't know. You know, it just might be. It works for me. And I'm living with a group of really wonderful friars at St. Bonaventure. And I was talking with the guardian. And he said, one of the dangers is that because what I said earlier about how Francis is kind of easy to get, we sometimes will hide behind Franciscan as opposed to Catholic. Because people get Franciscan better than they get Catholic. And sometimes Catholic can be problematic for people, right? Because there are lots of other issues and lots of stuff in the media and all that kind of stuff. So we always have to see this sponsor identity, of course, as an expression of our Catholic faith. Because that's where that link is most important. So we can't just say, hey, we're Franciscan, or hey, we're Jesuit, or hey, we are that because we are Catholic. Because our founders were trying to find a way to serve the church, not themselves. Okay? So I think sometimes we have to make sure that we do a better job of making sure that we maintain the kind of creative tension that we need between our Catholic identity and our sponsor identity. Let me just give you a little bit of information about us, because it's interesting how this all happens. I mentioned a little bit of it earlier. So I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. I was a city kid. Kathy was a suburban kid. But we went to neighboring urban high schools. My mom was not a churchgoer. She was Catholic, but was not a churchgoer. She was kind of agoraphobic. She didn't like crowds. God, of blessed memory, my mother. My dad, very simple guy. You know, when Vatican II happened and they stopped saying Mass in Latin, he stopped going. Never spoke a word of Latin in his life, other than the responses at Mass on Sunday. But I was like, it was change, right? It was change. He was like, I'm not going to go to church anymore. It's not Latin. Okay. Whatever. So if Dad doesn't go to church, it was not walking distance from my home, so my brother and I didn't go to church. But I kept going to Catholic school. So I went to church whenever I was in school, but we didn't go to Sunday Mass. And it wasn't until I had a driver's license that I started going back to church on Sunday. I remember the first time I went to the Feast of the Assumption at Our Lady of Victory Catholic Church just outside of Baltimore. And I was like, I'm glad I came back. I kind of like this. I've never been far from the faith, but it's like, you know, it's good to go to church again. And then, of course, over the next number of years, I started going to church. Well, you know, my dad started going to church again. My mom never went regularly. But I felt like good that my journey had led my dad back to church, which was something that was really important. But education was always a part of that for me. You know, Kathy brought a more traditional style of Catholic worship. Her parents were very devout, regular church goers. And so really, the continued growth of my own spirituality was what Kathy brought to me. And I think when you think about, you know, those of us who are married in the room or those of you who may be married someday, it's like, that's the wonderful thing about kind of a couple relationship, right? Is you form each other along the way. And that's something, Kathy was really important to me doing that. So one of the formative conversations we had, it's like I said, I went to senior prom with her. We dated for a year, then she dumped me.
I deserved it.
I did not deserve it. I did deserve it. I was a jerk. She dumped me. I spent the next year begging her to come back, and I finally got her to come back. None of the other women I dated in that intervening time were ever worth it. You know, it's like, I went to Kathy instead. We got back together. We went to senior college and everything. So we were engaged between our junior and senior years of college, and we got married the the year after we graduated from college. But we were having this conversation. We were having this conversation about, like, you know, how many kids you want to have? I'm one of two. Kathy was one of five, and Kathy said, I think I want nine. And I was like, what? She said, I want a baseball team. I was like, can we have maybe a basketball team with like a one reserve? How many weird? So we got married and said, okay, well, let's figure it out. So we got married in February of 1982, pregnant in August of 82, and had a baby in 83, 84, 86, 88, 90, 92, and 94. So we had the first seven. We had six girls and a boy. So it was a girl, girl, boy, then girl, 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 girl. We kept trying to have that brother, right? And life was good. We were doing well, you know, it was moving along. But it was funny. In our first seven children, I had seven different jobs. Because every time we have a kid, it's like, I need to make more money. And so I'd just get another job, always in higher education, almost always in higher ed. And so we did that. And then, you know, God's funny. I like to say, you know, God has a plan. I have no idea what that plan is, but there is a plan. And so our journey together has been basically saying, well, let's try to figure out what God's plan is for us and go with it. You know, let's just go with it. So we wound up moving a number of different times with the kids. We got to North Carolina. We got our first adopted daughter, Stephanie, who's from Ecuador. She was a teenager when she joined our family. Then we moved from North Carolina back to Pennsylvania. We wound up meeting these two Franciscan sisters whose ministry was foster care. And they were fostering three little kids. And we got to know them. And we wound up adopting those three kids. And then they're biological to one another. Their biological sister was with another foster family that she needed to be cared for. So then she joined our family. So then that took us from 7 to 8 to 12 kids. That's how we got 12. One of our Jewish neighbors, Mr. Cohen, he has 12 as well, I think, right?
11 or 12.
11 or 12. And the first time he met us, he says, I have 12 too, but you cheated. I was like, well, it doesn't feel like we cheated, I can tell you that. So our kids are, our oldest daughter is 40. She'll turn 41 next week, right, yeah. So 40 down to 29. And then the four youngest are 19, 18, 17, 15. Okay, wow. So we have kind of a gap in there. And of the older kids, you know, 20, you know, from a higher education perspective, you know, once we became college educated, for us, college was a part of the journey, is part of the journey for us. And so we went all in. So our eight older kids have 15 college degrees. And almost all of them went to Catholic colleges except for one, and they do all kinds of really great work. Well, I'm here at the end of my time. You know, let me just leave you with this. Francis had a vision. He was kneeling before what we now know as the San Damiano cross, and he heard the voice of God, and the voice of God said something like this: rebuild my church, for as you can see, it has fallen into ruin. It's time for us to rebuild our church. And education is the key to doing that. So I thank you for being with us today and for letting me ramble on for a bit. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Dave. Mike, it was interesting, inspiring, and entertaining all at once. I'm just going to go through the announcements real quick. Our next gathering will be on Friday, June 7th. Our program will feature author Edward Josa, whose topic will be The Mystic Next Door, An Ordinary Man's Extraordinary Encounter with the Holy Spirit. There are various ways to make reservations. I'm just going to mention, call our phone number at 330-535-7668 to make a reservation. Go to our website, and you can make a reservation via Eventbrite. If you're not on our emailing list, please see one of the board members and give us your email, and we'll get you signed up for that too. I'm going to move on real quick. I'd like to recognize those, and if you have any questions that you have written, please hold those up, and Steve will pick them up. Please raise your hand if you're a first-time attendee. We'd like to welcome you. I'd like to recognize our students from Archbishop Hoban, Our Lady of the Elms, and Walsh Jesuit. Give us a wave, students. And then I'd like to recognize the board members. Board members, please raise your hands. Okay, got any questions? Okay. Get me right away. What are your thoughts on the current college demonstrations occurring across the country?
One of the things I think really is what separates kind of public institutions from Catholic institutions is we don't really, because we believe in Catholic, not only the Catholic intellectual tradition, but Catholic social justice, we frame those conversations on our campuses very differently. So, for instance, you're not going to see many of those kind of protests on our Catholic college and university campuses. I think there is, it's a very complex situation, what we're dealing with today, right? And I don't believe that these kind of violent protests really bring us any closer to resolution. What brings us closer to resolution is dialogue grounded in respect for one another and humanity. I think that what we talk about at our Catholic, you mentioned earlier about my focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, we have to recognize the humanity of each other. And I think often we vilify the humanity of the other. Our Catholic college university campuses are places where we need to recognize the humanity of every person on the campus. What I would say at Notre Dame, you know, no matter where the student came from, I said, my perspective is I believe each and every one of you is a unique and beautiful creation of a loving God. So therefore, I'm going to treat you like that. And I would hope that you would treat me like that. So I think that we have to be called to be better in terms of treating each other humanely.
This is a group of questions. I'm trying to concentrate it down. This historically would probably be interesting. What was the primary cause of so many of the originally religiously sponsored upper higher education institutions to no longer be religiously affiliated?
Sure, and that happened over time, right? So the Congregationalists that founded Harvard, you know, persisted for many years, right? So they had Congregationalist presidents for many of their first presidents. And then over time, they saw their role in an expansive kind of more general educational kind of a way as an educational leader. And a lot of these, you know, how many of you know any Congregationalists today, right? So some of these religious communities diminished over time as well. At one point, you know, Mike had mentioned I worked at Elizabethtown College. Elizabethtown College was one of six colleges founded by the Church of the Brethren. Church of the Brethren, I'm sure there's some Brethren churches in Ohio.
Yeah.
Church of the Brethren, the Mennonites, and the Amish are all part of the same Anabaptist and Pietist tradition. They've maintained six institutions, but there's probably only about 100,000 Brethren in the country. So they serve largely non-Brethren students, okay? So some of it was some of the things that we're seeing is that the populations they were serving diminished, and so they began serving others, and that changed the identity of the institution over time.
What do you see as the biggest difference between a college education at a Catholic institution and other colleges? Mm-hmm.
You know, there. Everybody has a mission statement, right? You go to every college, university. Ohio State has a mission statement. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure they have one, right? But I believe that properly erected, the Catholic College and University has a mission that's grounded in gospel values that separates it from other institutions. Now, there are certainly some other fine church-related institutions as well. But I believe that that grounding in the intellectual tradition, grounded in gospel values, grounded in the Word of God, it gives us a foundation from which we can build and do our work that separates us from other institutions. So again, getting back to the protest question, you know, when we talk about, you know, the humanity of one another, and we see that as an expression of our faith, well, then that allows us to think differently about these kinds of things. So that's, and some of that's secular versus religious, right? I think the religious identity really helps us kind of navigate those waters more more smoothly.
What do you think is the meaning and purpose of Catholic education, and specifically, what do you think about Catholic education that is unique in comparison to other institutions?
Well, you know, like I said early on, I think the Catholic education is important to the life of the church. I think we have to educate as parents, we do, but we also have to say, as a church, we have a responsibility to educate our young people, our students. Continue. One of the things that Kathy did in part of her career, and she was a pastoral associate at Our Lady of Lourdes in St. Louis, which was more around adult faith formation, right? We have to constantly, as a church, we have to teach. You know, it's like Jesus was a teacher, right? He was a rabbi, right? So we have to understand that there's a teaching role of the church, and it's how do we teach? It's like we are, you know, we have to help everyone form conscience. You know, we're nothing if we don't have conscience, if we don't have free will, right? Because we have to freely choose. You know, I can't get salvation because you give it to me, right? I have to choose salvation. And I'm better off choosing that salvation if I have a fully formed conscience and a fully formed mind that can understand that. So for me, it's like if we're really focused on salvation around identity, education is an important underpinning to that. So I think that's what is unique about the Catholic school experience. We should really be focused on salvation and education.
Here's a personal one. How are your younger children going to be handling the move?
Not well.
You know, it's interesting, and I'll comment a little bit more on this. So we have these older kids, you know, 7 of the 8 of them are married. There's 11 grandchildren among them. They're all doing really well. They're still very active in their faith, and we feel great about all of that. Our younger kids, you know, they come from a different space, right? And a lot of times what we see with kind of adopted children, that there's early life trauma has a real big impact on development. And frankly, we've struggled with that, you know. And so our 19-year-old has not graduated from high school, is out on her own. We're not sure where her journey is going to take her. Our 18-year-old is now in a Job Corps program, going hopefully get his GED, become a nurse. The 17-year-old is in high school. We think he's there today, don't we? Yeah. And he wants to be in the Navy. We're like, I think that's a good choice for you, right? I said, if a boat pulled up at the end of my driveway and said, we want you, I would say, you got him. And then our 15-year-old is at Beaumont School. She's doing really well, you know. And so the two youngest are the ones that will move with us. We're bribing them at this point in terms of how we get them to do that, but it's going to be a process. It's not the first time we've moved teenage kids, but we'll figure it out, right? It's but thanks for asking.
I've got a few more questions. I'm just going to give them to you because we're running out of time.
Okay.
Again, thank you for that. All those candid reflections. We do appreciate that. It's my pleasure now to introduce Our Lady of the Elm student, Hazel Paramore, who will offer our closing prayer. Thank you again.
Father, thank you so much for helping bring all of these amazing schools together for this first Friday in May. We are so grateful for everyone who was able to be here today and that we got to learn from some great people about what we can do to strengthen ourselves spiritually and also those in our community. We ask that you bless every aspect of this event, from the speakers to the attendees and organizers. May this first Friday be a special time for spiritual growth, learning, and fellowship for us that we can take back into our own lives and help others. And we say all these things gratefully in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you so much, Hazel. I want to thank everyone for coming. Hopefully we'll see some of you next month. Please feel free to grab some of those leftover desserts on the table. And again, thank you to Dr. Mike for the wonderful presentation.